grew up in California. You were educated and received a PhD in the United States, and then visited Rishikesh, India, in, I believe, 1996. And you were there for 3 months and returned the next year and have been living there ever since. So
Yes.
it's amazing and unusual, it's an unusual journey to go to India. And I've heard you describe your travels to India as reluctant initially, and yet to be so struck that you ended up essentially living your life there, and you were, living in an ashram with your teacher. Can you, for our readers, just tell us a little bit about what happened during that 3 month initial visit that caused you to go back and caused you to stay?
Absolutely. And interestingly, most of the life-changing events happened literally within the first 3 days to 3 weeks. It did not even take 3 months to make me know that that's where I was meant to be. As you alluded to, I was a reluctant spiritual traveler because I was not someone who identified as spiritual to begin with. I was an academic and a good academic. I did well in school. I got into Stanford, then was in the midst of graduated from Stanford, then was in the midst of doing my PhD in pediatric neuropsych. So academics played a huge role in my life, in my identity. I was a social person. I was most definitely not someone you would have said, oh, she's gonna, grow up and become a monk and live in the mountains. Definitely, I did not have that personality that anyone would have thought that I was going to take this life path. And I also, along with all of that, was really struggling with early childhood trauma that had left very powerful ramifications upon my psyche. And so, as an adolescent, as someone in my early 20s, a lot of my emotional energy and a lot of my self-identification was also wrapped up in dealing with all of that. So I had been severely abused in early childhood, then abandoned, and ended up severely bulimic in my adolescence and was in and out of eating disorder treatments, hospitals, etc. And so the fact that I was also able to succeed so well academically, scientifically, was a bonus, unsurprising to people actually who study the psychology of eating disorders and the perfectionism that so many of us also embody along with the addiction. But I mention all of this because the fact that I was not on a spiritual path was not something that even occurred to me as a lack or an absence or something that I should be doing. It was like my plate was full between the course load, between my relationships, between dealing with my emotions and addiction and all of that. Like I didn't have any awareness that there was something else that I should be putting onto my plate. And so I agreed to go to India. Quite reluctantly, I didn't know anything about it, but I agreed to go because I was a very strict vegetarian and also an avid traveler. And in all of the places I traveled, it was very difficult, and it's still difficult on some in some ways, but 35 years ago, it was quite difficult in places, especially where you don't speak the language, to get pure vegetarian food. But I knew that if I could find an Indian restaurant anywhere, that I was sure to get pure vegetarian food at an Indian restaurant. So I agreed to go to India, as embarrassing as it is, almost 30 years later, because I actually liked the food. So we come to India. I was there with my husband, who was on a spiritual path, but it was really clear in our relationship that that was his thing. I had other things, and there was very little, if any at all, overlap or crossover with that. But he wanted to go to India. I wanted to keep my marriage together and loved to travel. So I said, okay. So we go to India, and Rishikesh was the first place that we came, really only because I opened a 500-page Lonely Planet guidebook in Delhi and said, Rishikesh. We didn't know about it in advance. Neither of us had had any time to research things in advance. There was no Google that you would just go to and say where to go. So we didn't really know anything. I opened this guidebook in Delhi, and Rishikesh sounded great. It was mountains, it was a river, it was yoga, and it was relatively close to Delhi and easy to get to. We get to Rishikesh, and I walk down to the river, which is the Ganga River, the mother goddess Ganga River. But I didn't know that this river was the goddess. I just knew it was a river. I am a nature person. I've always been a nature person. Mountains, trees, forests, rivers, that's my happy place. So it was just really natural for me after a day of travel to say, oh, I'm going to go sit by the river. And that's exactly what I said. And that's exactly what I did. Dumped the luggage in the hotel, and I said, I'm going to sit by the river. I get down to this river, having no idea that the river is holy, having no idea that this is the embodiment of the mother goddess. And I look out over the river, and I spontaneously had this extraordinary experience of being in the presence of the divine. And it was not a sense of, oh, this is a Hindu divine or any box around it. It was just a pervasive experience, a felt sense experience of everything being pervaded by the divine. And it began as I looked out over the river, but then even as I turned my head and looked at other things, it didn't matter what I was looking at. What I was seeing much more clearly than the differences in form was the similarity in content of that divinity in everything, whether it was a tree or a family or a telephone pole or marble steps or an old woman bathing. It didn't matter what I looked at. All I saw was the divine. And it knocked me quite literally to the ground. And at some point, I turned that vision inward and realized, oh my God, I am not separate from that pervasive divine. As a young woman who had struggled with sexual abuse and eating disorders, I was filled with self-hatred, I was filled with negativity, I was filled with identifications around all of that that was wrong about me. I was filled with an inherent sense of unworthiness. And suddenly, in that moment, it was like, oh my God, you are not wrong or dark or bad or this or that. You are divine, you are inseparable from that pervasive presence of the divine. And it was just the most extraordinary thing. And it just in that moment wiped out almost immediately all of the identifications that I previously had carried around who I thought I was. And suddenly there was no border, there was no boundary, there was no distinction between me and this presence of the divine. And I knew in that moment, this is where I'm meant to be. And I didn't know doing what, I didn't know living where, I didn't know why. None of it made sense. But that didn't matter because my entire logical academic brain had been essentially rendered into, like soup. And I was pretty nonverbal for many, many, many days. All I could say was just, oh my God, it's so beautiful. Oh my God, it's so beautiful. And I had tears pouring down my eyes or pouring down my face from my eyes. And I knew I was meant to be there. The fact that I didn't understand why or how or where or doing what, it didn't bother me. I just was aware of the fact that there were all of these unknowns, but that didn't matter because it was so clear that that's where I was meant to be. And then over the next 10 to 12 days, a series of extraordinary things happened, ranging from literally hearing a voice as I walked through Paramarth Niketan, the ashram that I live in, telling me, you must stay here, to literally getting my feet glued to the ground of the ashram when I tried to walk out, to finally meeting Pujaswami ji, my guru, who's the president of Paramarth, Pujaswami Chidanand Saraswati ji, and just a series of these experiences that continued to open my heart, like really blow it open, and just made it so much more tangibly clear. Oh, here, like here in Paramarth Niketan Ashram, is where you're meant to be. And oh, it's here under this amazing teacher and master that you are meant to be and meant to learn and meant to study and meant to serve and meant to grow. So it really did not take actually very long, although 3 months was, as you said, the duration of the trip that my husband and I had planned. But by the end of the 3 months, it was so obvious to me that there was no way I was meant to be anywhere other than in Rishikesh. But actually, my guru sent me back and made me go back and made me finish the following semester of my PhD program. And it was extraordinary because he intuited something that I, living in that world, had not realized, which was the impact upon people who had not had the spiritual experience that I had. Because, when you have these experiences, you forget that the rest of the world has not also had one. And so when I started gushing to my parents, who, we talked once a week, and the week before I had talked about finally finding a cup of, good coffee in Delhi. And then the following week, I'm talking about God and Ganga, and I'm sure I was totally incoherent. And naturally, it panicked them. I didn't realize that at the time. And the impact upon people at my PhD program, the impact upon people in my community. And Swamiji realized that, and he made me go back and he made me finish the next semester and he made me get straight A's and he made me face that world so that no one could ever say, oh, she ran away. Oh, she was brainwashed. Oh, she went crazy. Oh, she joined a cult. Oh, she, any of the things that we would naturally gravitate toward when you think of, young white academic Californian women suddenly deciding to abandon everything and move to an ashram on the banks of Ganga. But it's been now almost 30 years, and it's been just the most extraordinary blessing.
Thank you for sharing that. I really want to spend a moment exploring the experience, that initial experience you had. Having been in Rishikesh a couple of times, I can kind of picture, I don't know exactly where you were, but I can picture the Ganga, and it's beautiful, and you are kind of in the mountains, and there's ashrams along the banks. And there's just a very sacred energy to the whole place. So I'm imagining you there. I'm imagining you looking out over this river that, up until that moment, was just a river, as you described, just a river to a Western woman visiting India. And suddenly you feel this pervasive sacred divinity everywhere. And what I wanted to ask you about is that, I don't know, thousands upon thousands of people see that river every year, and yet you saw it and were catapulted into a recognition of the inherent divinity of all of existence. Why do you think that happens? Have you thought about it? Have you thought about why? Why did that open up for you the way that it did?
Well, I think first of all that it is available to everyone. It is certainly not that I was the first person in history to have a powerful spiritual transformation on the banks of the Ganga River, the Ganges River. I think more people than not have very powerful experiences there. But as someone not from the Hindu culture, as someone who was not Indian, as someone who was not primed to know that I was going to a holy, sacred place and that this river was the embodiment of the goddess and liberation, I think really what I attribute it to was an openness and a sincerity and a willingness that I really consciously had cultivated. Although I was not religious and not even someone who says, well, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual, I was deeply committed to truth. I was deeply committed to openness. And on the airplane to India, I remember so vividly this conversation I had with myself saying, this makes no sense. You are traveling literally across the world to a place you know nothing about, a place you're not even interested in going to, whose only seeming redeemable factor is that you can get good vegetarian food. But I was living in the San Francisco Bay Area. Like, I got good Indian vegetarian food on my corner, and I wasn't limited to Indian vegetarian food. I got lots of good vegetarian food. I cooked good vegetarian food. So I realized that it didn't make logical sense. And so I took a vow, and the vow said, look, since none of this makes sense to me, there must be a reason that I'm going that I'm not aware of, because all of the reasons that I've said don't make sense. And what that means is that there's a reason and I just can't see it. And therefore, I took this vow to keep my heart open. And I said, if you cannot keep your heart open, then get out of India, come back to California. Okay, I'm not registered for that autumn semester of my PhD program, but I can get practicum units. I can start research on my dissertation. I mean, there was a lot of stuff that I could do if I did not want to stay in India for the full 3 months. And so I said, look, either keep your heart fully open to whatever the reason might be that you are being called there, or come back and do something useful. So I really, really consciously committed to keeping my heart open. And I think that that played a really important role.
That's beautiful. I think that's a, that's just something for all of us to really take to heart, that commitment to openness, because in your case, you weren't overtly spiritual, that, and you probably represent many, many people who aren't overtly spiritual, and yet your openness of heart made something truly extraordinary happen. And this issue, what I wanted to explore was the power that spiritual practice, both in some of its traditional, more traditional forms, and some of its more recent manifestations. The question of what is the value of spiritual practice for the modern world? And you are, a thoroughly modern individual. You were raised in the West. You are now an internationally known spiritual teacher, teaching a fairly, you're teaching a fairly traditional form of Vedanta, but teaching it, I think, particularly. Well, I don't know. I'll let you say, but my experience is you are definitely making it accessible to Westerners, this wisdom from the tradition. And I believe that those of us who devote ourselves to sharing spiritually, very often, if we look at that initial experience, which, as is true in your situation, it often happens pretty early on in our spiritual life, that we are opened in a way that changes the direction of our life. And if you look at that kind of experience, you can often see what it is that any teacher is fundamentally sharing. And so I want to ask you if, having described that experience, would you say that that experience of recognizing your own non-separation from the divine presence of existence is fundamentally what you want to share with your teachings and practices?
Interesting question. So, yes, it is. And yet, it doesn't require people either to pick up their lives and go from wherever they are to Rishikesh. It doesn't require that the experience happen on the banks of Ganga. And it doesn't require that they have the personal, full, felt sense awareness of that in order to embrace the teachings. I certainly hope that as people deepen and practice and open, that they all will have that felt sense awareness, but it's not a prerequisite to access the teachings. What I want people to really understand and to know is that they're not their stories. For me, the first 25 years of my life was so wrapped up in my false identification, my story of who I thought I was, and whether it was in relation to the abuse, the abandonment, or the eating disorder, or whether it was in relation to the A pluses I was getting in school, or whether it was in relation to my relationships, romantic relationships, friend group relationships, whether it was in relation to, sports that I did or anything else. I was so focused externally on my identity. And so what that leads to is so much stress, so much suffering because, oh my God, yeah, you better keep getting straight A's because, hey, that's who you are. That is your redeeming quality as a human being. So yeah, you better not let that slip. And, my identity in relationship was so intense and so wrapped up in the story of the abuse and abandonment that I had suffered. And so I had carried these these stories, these wounds, these narratives into every relationship. And obviously, it made relationships very, very intense, but also very difficult, and also a huge aspect of my personal identity. Like, I was okay as long as you still loved me, whether, again, it was romantic or whether it was just a friend group situation. And if there was even the slightest chance that you did not love me, or that you might love someone more, that was not only an emotionally challenging situation, but that was devastating to the very core identity of self. And so the key teaching that I am really sharing with people and working to bring people in multiple ways, through experience, through meditation, through workshops, through activities, through specific tools and techniques, to teachings and satsang and lectures, to books, to all of the different possible avenues that I have. The core teaching is, you are not that story. You are the divine, regardless of what someone else says or does or projects onto you, regardless of what's happened to you, regardless of what you look like, regardless of what you can do or can't do. That isn't who you are. And if you can let go of that, you can let go of the suffering. And the way that I think about this, and kind of a fun framework for the teaching, is, the title of my memoir is Hollywood to the Himalayas. And in India we say Himalayas, but here we say Himalayas. Hollywood to the Himalayas. And it's not just a physical journey, but it's actually a mindset journey. And I think about it as, in the Hollywood mindset is the one in which we suffer. It's the one that says to you, regardless of where you live, because it's pervasive, not only in Hollywood, of course, that says you are your body, and you are its size and its shape and its color and its popularity and its success, and it's all of that, its history. And the identification as that causes us to suffer. It causes us to bring suffering to others. We gobble up the world. We grasp at the world, because if I am my body, then I need more money, more possessions, more prestige, more relationships, more this, more that. And the Himalayan way says, you have a body, but you're not the body. Your soul, your spirit, your consciousness. And that shift is a shift from suffering to the end of suffering. So, yeah, I would say that is definitely a core message in teaching. It's not the only one, but it's definitely a very, very core message. And then, of course, the other pieces that go along with it are, well, okay, so how do we let go of the false identifications? How do we let go of the Hollywood way of thinking? How do we access soul, spirit, consciousness? And so there's a lot of teachings and pillars around that, but that core shift is definitely something that I'm wanting people to know and experience, because we're suffering. And we're suffering, in India, if you look at suffering, it's because they don't have running water, or they don't have toilets and they have to go out into the jungle to go to the bathroom, or because a family member is sick and there's no money for medicine, or there's no hospital nearby, or there's no road to get to a hospital, or there's no, electricity. And here, so many of the people I interact with are suffering, but they're suffering not due to something that requires infrastructure or resources or the construction of a school or a hospital or a road. But it simply requires a shift in their way of thinking, a shift in their way of understanding, a shift in the way of responding or reacting and interpreting the world. And if we can just make that shift, our entire lives change. And we tend to blame other people and our outer circumstances for internally how we feel. And a really core pillar of what I want to share with people and help people understand is people are just, they're on their karmic journey. They're doing their thing with their karmic toolbox, and it's not about you. They're moving through their karmic journey. And your role is not to be the karmic police in terms of dictating their karmic journey, but your role is to be in charge of your karmic journey, which is to find the freedom, to find the joy, to find the peace that is the truth of who you are, regardless of other people's karmic journeys.
So this is fantastic. This interview went in directions I wasn't anticipating, but much better than I imagined.
Oh, fun.
And you know what I'm hearing you say right now, and I there was a YouTube video of yours about the purpose of life, and you emphatically stated, which is I think essentially what you're saying now, that the purpose of life is to find your true self. And so I would say that on the banks of the Ganga, you experienced your true self, your, you know, the inseparability with the divinity that pervades all. You know, you
Yes.
experienced that in a powerful way. And then, as one would with such an experience, you said, okay, this is, you know, I'm not going back. This is where
Yes.
I need to be. And I would anticipate, and from what you're saying, you're talking about how you want to teach people that they're not their stories, and that, you know, I know there's many practices that you teach and share, and perspectives and teachings. Over time, you know, what's interesting in those big experiences where you experience non-separation with divinity, it's one aspect of those experiences is it's obvious that this is who you are and who you always were. It's not that you became inseparable from divinity. You just recognize that's who you are.
Yes.
And so I'm imagining that over the 30 years, because you've spent 30 years as a renunciate living in an ashram with your guru, I'm sure that you have seen and discovered and recognized all of the many ways that we unknowingly divorce ourselves from our true selves, and the kinds of practices that support us to release all of that unconscious separation in order to come closer and closer and ultimately to realize our true self. I'm just curious if that's your experience, and maybe you could say a little bit about what you've seen that would benefit the seeker today who's feeling a desire for that kind of wholeness.
So, I think the core piece is that we are not anything other than whole. The dilemma is that we've been conditioned. We get conditioned first by our family of origin, where in varying degrees we are taught either implicitly or explicitly that we need to do something or be something in order to be worthy of love, in order to be worthy of goodness. And, you know, parents, most of them in any case, really are doing the very best they can. And they're just walking through this world and their karmic journey, but they're doing the best they can and they're not intending to mess us up completely. And the dilemma is that in trying to simply enforce what seems like kind of bare minimum discipline, they end up giving us messages that if we don't look at and unlearn, can really be debilitating. So if you take just something as seemingly innocuous as parents saying things like, "Oh, you cleaned up your room. You're such a good boy." That's pretty innocuous. I could, I would say probably 90% plus of parents have said something like that. And yeah, what does it teach us? It teaches us that our goodness is anchored in what we've done. Room is clean, we are good. Room is not clean, we are bad. And it obviously expands and gets worse into our schoolwork, into our athletic prowess or whatever area extracurricularly we may be, working, whether it's sports or music or art or other things. But we come home with report cards, and the report cards are good ones, and we get hugs and kisses and love and all of that. We come home with report cards that are not good. And even if we are fortunate enough to be raised by people who don't actually beat us or lock us in our rooms, we're certainly not being showered with love and hugs and kisses with failing report cards that we bring home. And so again, what we learn is come home with the good report card, you get love. Come home without the good report card and you don't. And so we wonder why we have generation after generation of workaholics, of people pleasers, of people who suffer anxiety, restlessness, self-hatred, self-esteem issues, self-confidence issues, fear in risk-taking, because our very worthiness is so rooted in these early experiences. And so what I've seen is the first piece is simply acknowledging that, simply noticing that we are carrying ideas that are not true. And the simple fact that they were given to us by people we love does not make them true. If most of us as adults look back on our parents at the age when we were given these sorts of false beliefs, our parents were in their, mid to late 20s, maybe early 30s. And we look back and we're like, oh my God, they were babies. They had no idea. I mean, how many of us would take life lessons on the very core, deepest nature of ourself from some random 26-year-old? And yet, that's kind of what our parents were in most cases. And because they were our parents, we've imbued them with this all-knowing divine wisdom, which is a critical part of early childhood psychological development. But it's something that as suffering adults, we really need to free ourselves from and to really be able to look at these beliefs that we're holding that keep us stuck and say, oh my God, I believe that I am worthless and lazy because my fifth grade teacher told me so. And, she was in the middle of a divorce and she was an alcoholic and she was a total racist and maybe I'm a person of color. And so, okay, she took out all of that on me. That does not make it true. And yet, for decades, we carry these beliefs because we internalize them as kids. So I, coming from a psychological background and then moving into spirituality, I find that the intersection of psychology and spirituality is a really powerful place because spirituality frees us. But psychology, I have found, is really important for the first stage of seeing, understanding, and beginning to unravel those cords that bind us. And then our spiritual practices can actually take us into a place of freedom that is not a spiritual bypass, that's not about repression or suppression or denial. And it's not a spiritual practice in which we find ourselves saying things like, oh my God, I can't talk to that person because, oh my God, my peace gets disturbed. Or, oh, I was feeling great today and then you came home and it's your fault that I'm no longer in peace. Our peace is so fragile and tenuous if we haven't actually done the psychological work under the spiritual practices. So I think that's a really important piece, is understanding kind of what beliefs are we holding that make us stuck. Then, in terms of shifting into the spiritual aspects of freedom, we look at them, we understand this is not true. This is a simple projection of someone else's ego, ignorance, fear, delusion onto me. And we get into deep spiritual work around, I am not this. And this is where practices like, for example, the Neti Neti meditation, which is one of my favorites, comes in. Because not only is it a really powerful meditative practice, but it's actually something really powerful to work with in your full day. You know, as you sit in meditation, you go through layer by layer. I am not this. I am not the clothes that I wear. I am not the skin beneath my clothes. I am not the blood flowing beneath my skin. I am not the organs. And layer by layer, until you get to a place where you find yourself saying things like, I am not dopamine. I am not serotonin. I am not norepinephrine. I am not an electrical charge cascading down an axon in a neuron in my brain. Well, if I'm not the chemistry and I'm not the electricity, it means I'm not my thoughts. It means I'm not my emotions, because every thought, every emotion, every memory, every feeling, the ones, you know, even that we identify so deeply as self, every one of them is just a pattern of chemical and electrical behavior in our neocortex mostly. You know, some of it goes a little deeper into the brain, but it's all in the physical brain. We're looking at gray matter, white matter, physical brain. Well, I am not that. And when you can really realize that, then in our meditation practices, as we go layer by layer of what we're not, we enter a state that the Buddhist practitioners tend to refer to as nothingness, and the Hindu practitioners tend to refer to as everythingness. But it's basically exactly the same space. It's just a different way of describing it. And you can then carry that practice into your day. It's a wonderful, wonderful way of freeing yourself during the day, because so many of us have the experience of gorgeous freedom as we sit in meditation in our rooms and our personal altars and shrines. And then we go out and we go to the office and we deal with traffic and neighbors and colleagues and family members, and we get so triggered and we completely forget. And it's only when we at night sit back in meditation that we're like, oh my God, I forgot. I lost myself again today. How did that happen again? And I love the practice of Neti Neti throughout the day because it reminds us. And so if someone says to you, you are awful, you are lazy, you are stupid, you are this, you are that, you just inside say, neety neety. The same way that you're not your clothes or your skin or your bones, you're not someone else's projections. I mean, if you're not your own chemistry and electricity, you're certainly not someone else's chemistry and electricity. Neety neety. But then, of course, when they say to you, oh my God, you're so wonderful, you're brilliant and amazing and beautiful, you can't take on that projection. If you take that on, you're going to take on the negative as well. The wave that goes up is going to come down. So when we get the positive projections as well, we have to remember, neti neti, not this, not this. And so that's one of many really powerful techniques that I love in bridging our meditative practice, our seated meditative practice, with our daily moving through the world in as close to a state of meditation as we possibly can.
Beautiful. That's wonderful, and I think it's a beautiful place for us to conclude our formal interview. So thank you very much for all that, Sadhvi.